2 Corinthians 10 is where we are this morning, verses 1 through 6 of 2 Corinthians 10. Well, sadly, the summer has ended, although I guess you wouldn't know it by the weather. It's pretty warm out there today. But we are at the end of the summer and approaching fall. Our summer sermon series is done. We've had a three-month break while we looked at other things, and now we're ready to get back into the book of 2 Corinthians. We've thus far made our way slowly through the first two major sections of the book. There's chapters 1 through 7 is section 1, and chapters 8 and 9 are the second section, and now we'll be into chapters 10 through 13, the last four chapters of the book, and that's the third and final section. You may remember that chapters 1 through 7 deal with Paul's relationship with the church. He's trying to explain what he's been doing. There's been some criticism of him and some people who are not quite happy with what he's doing. And so he kind of explains himself, what he's been doing over these last years as he's interacted with the church. Then in chapters 8 and 9, we have Paul's appeal to the people to participate in an offering. He's trying to collect some money for the poor saints at Jerusalem. The people there in Corinth had agreed. They had said that they would be involved with this offering. And then, unfortunately, they hadn't really delivered on it. And so Paul has to encourage them to get with the program and to collect their offering and be ready to participate in that. And then in the final part, this chapters 10 through 13, the final section of the book, Paul defends his ministry and denounces those who opposed him. Some of this material is the most personal writing that we have from the Apostle Paul in all of the Scripture. Of course, this is a church that he knew well. He had spent about a year and a half at least there at the church. He was really the founding pastor of that church. He knew the people well. He knew their problems well. He had written them several times. And so he does not hold back on his emotions as he speaks with these people. Of course, we've got the letter. This is the record of his letter that he sent to them. But it's very personal writing. Also, people have noticed that the tone of his writing changes here dramatically. In chapters 8 and 9, he's trying to encourage the people very warmly and personally to try to encourage them to participate in this offering. And then when we get into chapter 10, it's almost like he flips the switch, or he's about to, as we work into the passages here. He goes from a very personal appeal to them, very gracious in his tone and demeanor toward them, and he turns to a much more severe or strict way of dealing with these people. And so the tone changes dramatically. In fact, in the first two verses, he uses the word bold three times. And so he's kind of tipping them off. He's giving them a little bit of a hint that he's going to be much more bold and even severe with these people in these coming verses. The Corinthian church had a number of serious problems. 1 Corinthians, as we read, goes through a whole litany of problems. And so Paul is, again, trying to help these people solve their problems. He wants them to listen to him, to take his advice. And so he's trying to encourage them, but sometimes he has to be a little bit bold and authoritative. Some of the people there in the church had rebelled against his authority. Some of the false teachers, unfortunately, had penetrated the church and infiltrated there, and they were having an influence. So Paul deals with these people. He's about ready, at least, to deal with these people quite sternly and strictly. In attacking these problems, Paul saves the worst for the last. Sometimes we save the best for the last. Well, Paul deals with the most difficult things at the end. It's almost as if he wanted to deal with these other issues first, and now that he's gotten through all those other issues he's already dealt with, now he has to deal with this problem, this major problem. And so he deals with this quite strictly and severely. In the short letter, Paul is ready to wage war against the enemies of the church. He'll answer their false charges and expose their error and their rebellion. Notice in chapter 10, then, as we look at the first part here, this is dealing with spiritual warfare. Notice verse 3, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. And so he brings up this imagery now, this language of warfare. And obviously this means that he's going to be somewhat strict and somewhat severe, just like the Roman army, the Roman Empire and the Roman military. Everybody knew how strict and severe the Roman military was. And so now he's using this imagery and language of warfare. The weapons of our warfare in verse 4, pulling down strongholds, bringing into captivity. This is all military language. And he's using that kind of language for a purpose, because he's warning the people that he's going to be like a military commander with them if they don't shape up. And so this is kind of a warning for them. This is a spiritual battle. Of course, he's not talking about physical warfare, but it is a spiritual battle that he'll be engaging in. And so the people need to know that this is war. In fact, I would say that the main verb here is in verse 3, we do not war according to the flesh. He's going to be speaking quite a bit about this battle, this engagement that he'll be having in this warfare over the next few verses. The word here to war means to engage in a military campaign or to fight as a soldier. He describes this as our warfare in verse 4. So this is spiritual warfare. This is a fight. He's getting ready to fight against these false teachers, these people who had infiltrated the church and who were teaching against him and his authority. Do we engage in a spiritual warfare today? Are there any parallels between what Paul is going through and what we have to go through? Well, yes, we're not apostles. We're not, you know, interacting with a church like Paul does, but we're part of a church. And there may be spiritual battles that we have to put up with as well. Hopefully we don't have to deal with false teachers in the church, but we do have conflict occasionally within the church. Every church has conflict from time to time. And so we need to know not only how to engage in conflict, but also just in general, how to wage a spiritual warfare. And we need to see that some of these conflicts and these problems have a spiritual basis. This is spiritual warfare. And Paul is not, he doesn't hesitate to use this kind of language of warfare occasionally. You know, over there in Ephesians 6, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and rulers of the darkness of this world. So there's often spiritual warfare going on in the letters and the writing of Paul, and here's another example of that. He's ready to fight. He's ready to engage in this warfare. And likewise, we have an opportunity, we have a responsibility to engage in spiritual warfare ourselves. So this passage tells us some important things about how to wage war in our spiritual battles, spiritual struggles against our spiritual enemies. In this rather short passage, just verses 1 through 6, we have a lot of information. It often happens to me when I begin researching and begin my preparation for a passage, you read through it and you say, I say to myself, well, what am I going to say about this? And I read through it a few more times and I do some more research. Oh, okay, here's this, here's that. Oh, I guess I could say this and here's that. And I come across more and more. And pretty soon I have 20 pages of notes. Actually, I have more than 20 pages of notes. And if you would be inclined to sit here for the next 2 hours, I'd be happy to go through all my notes. But I don't think most people want to sit here for 2 hours, so I'm going to break it up into two parts, part one and part two. Today I'll get basically through verse 3. But there's so much material here, on just a cursory reading, you might not understand everything that's going on here or see all the applications. But this is really a meaty text. And the more I studied it, the more I reviewed it, the more I thought about it, the more material came to my mind. And so instead of trying to get through the whole six verses just all at once, I've decided to try to break it up. And this is, you know, I guess typical of me when I tend to do part one, two, three sometimes of one message. But we'll consider hopefully verses 1 through 3 today, and then next time the rest of this passage, verses 1 through 6. So what do we find here about waging spiritual warfare? First of all, wage spiritual warfare with Christ-like meekness and gentleness. He says, now I, Paul, myself, this is chapter 10, verse 1, I, Paul, myself, am pleading with you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, who in presence am lowly among you, but being absent am bold toward you. He starts out by saying he wants to plead with them, or he's appealing to them by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. He actually begins with a personal appeal. Paul appeals to them personally. He says, now I, Paul, myself. In other words, he's not writing on account of anybody else. Nobody else is writing this. He's appealing to them on the basis of his own personal relationship with these people. And remember that he is the founding pastor of that church. He went there, preached the gospel, people got saved, he started the church. The Bible tells us in Acts that he was there in Corinth for about a year and a half working with his people. So these are all essentially his converts, and the converts of the people, the other people working with him. So he knows these people very well, and they know him. He's appealing to them on that basis of a personal relationship, that they know him well. He's not going to lead them astray. They know that he's an apostle sent by Jesus Christ to do this very work. And so he's encouraging them. In fact, notice the language here. I'm pleading with you. This word means to exhort or to beg. He wants them to listen to him. Please listen to me. Please hear what I'm trying to tell you. In fact, he uses that same kind of language in verse 2, where he says, "But I beg you that when I'm present, I may not be bold." So he's begging, he's urging them, it's a different word here, to listen to him. This is an urgent appeal, an urgent request. Although he's appealing to them gently and with meekness, he's still trying to see that, he's trying to get them to see that they need to listen to what he's trying to tell them. He's appealing to them on the basis of their personal relationship, but also he appeals to them on the basis of, as he says here, the meekness and gentleness of Christ. In other words, he's trying to be Christ-like in this war that he's about to begin. He needs to talk with these false teachers. He needs to try to get rid of these false teachers and root them out of the church. But he wants to do this in a very meek and gentle way because that's Christ-like. Christ is meek and gentle, and Paul says, I want to be that way as well. He mentions these two particular attitudes, one, meekness. The word here means humility or mildness or moderation. It's the opposite of harshness or severity. A meek person is considerate, patient, and gracious, just like Jesus was. Somebody put it this way, meekness is the humble and gentle attitude that expresses itself in patient endurance of unfair treatment. So the meekness is one thing, and then he goes on to use the word gentleness, which is almost synonymous with meekness. It's a very similar idea. Some would define gentleness as sweet reasonableness. A gentle person is mild, fair-minded, and easy to get along with. And since he's not here today, I'll mention his name. Somebody that occurred to me when that idea, these ideas of meekness and gentleness came up, a person came to mind, and that's Earl Steger. Some of you know Earl. Now, I know him pretty well. I've known him over the years, and I would say for me, he's a reasonable person, a person easy to know and easy to talk with. Maybe some of you know him in ways that I don't. Maybe he's got a bad temper or something. I don't know that. But Earl seems to be just the sweetest guy. When I think of a sweet gentleman, I think of Earl Steger. He really is a nice guy. So I would suggest that he has that kind of attitude. We can be meek and gentle like a gentleman is, like Earl Steger. And when these two words are used together in other ancient literature, the sense seems to be kind of like leniency or forbearance. Paul was trying to be lenient to these people, just like a parent. I mean, generally speaking, parents don't want to punish their children. Good parents, at least, want to be lenient or forbearing of their behavior. They want to give their children the benefit of the doubt. They don't want to be punishing their children all the time, disciplining their children all the time. They want to be kind toward them. They want to be gentle toward them. And so Paul says, like a father, I want to be gentle toward you as well. So why does he have to make this kind of an appeal? Well, going on in the verse, who in presence am lowly among you, but being absent am bold toward you. So this is likely an accusation that Paul is responding to that he heard from some of the people there in Corinth. They were making this accusation against him, and he's responding to it. They're saying something like, when he's with us, he's humble and gentle, but when he's absent, he's stern and bold. He's severe from a distance, but spineless up close. He's bold on paper, but bashful in person. So this is an accusation, really, of cowardice. Sure, it's easy to write something harsh and severe when you're away from us, but when you're here, you seem very timid and very kind of too gentle. In fact, we can go on to verse 10, skip over to verse 10, where we have this accusation very clear. Verse 10 says, for his letters, they say, are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech contemptible. That's what they were charging him with. They were basically saying, you know, when you're with us, you're very peaceful and mild, and then when you leave, you send us these scathing, bitter letters. And you may remember that Paul had sent them a severe letter previously. He had been with the church. He had visited there. There was some kind of a conflict came up. It seems like they had treated him with disrespect. He ended up leaving early, earlier than he had planned, because he didn't want to extend this conflict. And then once he had left, he sent them this severe letter. And fortunately, they responded properly or positively to this letter. But he had to leave because he didn't want to extend this conflict. He wanted to be gracious. And because of this conflict, he felt like he had to be severe. But he didn't want to do that while he was there. He had to leave, and then he sent them a severe letter. So that's kind of the accusation that these people, at least these false teachers, were making against Paul, that sure, he's with us, he's kind and generous and gentle and everything, but then when he leaves, he sends us these scathing letters. It's almost like today, you know, people in with social media, how people often write or type out, you know, they put down these posts that are really severe, they're very caustic, they're very unkind. They say the kinds of things, you know, over the computer that they would never say in person. Well, that's the way that people are sometimes, and that's kind of the accusation that the people are making here against Paul. Well, Paul, in response to that, reminds his readers that Jesus himself was meek and gentle. And so Paul is simply trying to be Christ-like when dealing with the problems of the church. He's doing this intentionally because it is easier to deal with the problem sometimes from a distance. He's intentionally trying to be kind and merciful toward them while he's there. And if he can't do that, well, then when he writes a letter, he'll be severe. Because Jesus was somewhat like that as well. Jesus was kind and meek and gentle for the most part, although at times he was aggressive and assertive. He had all power, Jesus did, at his disposal. He was the Lord of glory, but normally he dealt with people with great gentleness and kindness. Think of, for example, the woman at the well. He pointed out her sin, but he dealt with her very gently, or even the woman taken in adultery. Again, he dealt with the lady with gentleness and kindness and graciousness. But with the scribes and Pharisees, the hypocrites, we just talked about that a few weeks ago, about how stern and how severe Jesus was with these religious hypocrites. So Jesus saved, I think, most of his aggressiveness and his assertiveness for unrepentant sinners. And normally speaking, as Jesus himself said, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So he came across with gentleness. And our normal way of dealing with people should be with Christ-like meekness and gentleness. Now, Paul is about to say, I'm going to go to war, but I'd rather not do that. If I can deal with you with meekness and gentleness, kindness, patience, I'd rather do that. And really, that should be our default setting as well. We should strive to be kind and lenient with people as much as possible, and especially in this context, dealing with conflicts within the church. Within the church, as we have to deal with conflicts or we deal with difficult people, whatever it might be, we should approach them with a great deal of meekness and gentleness. Remember, over in Galatians, it says, those who are spiritual try to restore a one in a spirit of gentleness or meekness, lest you also be tempted. So whenever we're dealing with difficult situations or problem people, the default setting, you might say, the attitude that we have going into that is not warfare. We'll get to that in a moment, but we should go into that situation with meekness. A common expression is you can catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. And of course, that's not a biblical statement, but it's true as far as it goes. Generally speaking, when we're trying to appeal to people and reach people, we often make more headway. Things go better if we try to deal with people with meekness and gentleness, with kindness. So being humble and gentle and kind ought to be the normal way that we behave with people. The normal setting is that we are meek, kind, and gentle. These are Christ-like attitudes that we must imitate, especially when dealing with conflict within the church, or I would say conflict anywhere. Whenever we're dealing with that in our lives, it could be at home, it could be at work, it could be at school. Whenever we have these conflict, difficult situations, we want to apply the meekness and gentleness of Christ. However, there are times when that doesn't solve the problem. There are times when a little bit more sternness is necessary. So we go on to verse 2, wage spiritual warfare with boldness and confidence. He says in verse 2, but I beg you that when I am present, I may not be bold with that confidence by which I intend to be bold against some who think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. So Paul states his desire here to be kind and lenient, to be meek and gentle with these people. He wants to avoid this conflict as much as he can, but he says there may be a time when this meek and mild approach doesn't solve the problem, and then he's going to be strict and severe. He is an apostle, and he's not afraid of exercising his apostolic authority over the church that he started. It'd be something else, I suppose, if it was somebody else's church or whatever, but he knows these people. They know him. He started this church, and so he feels like he has the right to be authoritative with them. So he starts out there, verse 2, I beg you that when I'm present, I may not be bold with this authority or this confidence. So he'd rather avoid using his authority. He'd rather spare them and spare himself the unpleasant duty of dealing with these problems. And most spiritual leaders, most pastors, I think, would probably say that they'd rather not have to deal with people with sternness or with authoritativeness. It'd be far easier to deal with people with gentleness and meekness. Dealing with conflicts is never easy. It's never fun. But if you can deal with people on a very gracious basis, it's much better than having to be stern. But Paul's not afraid of using that sternness if he has to. He's begging or pleading that they could avoid this painful experience. Notice that he uses the word bold here a couple of times. The first word bold, there are actually two different words in the original language. The first word bold means to be courageous or firm in the face of danger. He doesn't want to have to exercise this courage, but he is courageous and he's bold enough to do that if he has to. The second word bold here often is translated as dare to do something. He dares to be bold and courageous if necessary. One thing that we know about Paul is that he was not lacking courage. Think of Paul standing before Agrippa and these other kings. He's standing before the Jewish authorities. He's standing up against other authorities like in prisons. He's been shipwrecked. He's had all these terrible experiences. I get the sense that Paul was normally as bold as a lion. I don't think he was afraid of anything. And so his boldness here, he's basically saying, I dare to stand in front of you. I dare to do what needs to be done. There's nothing lacking in his courage. What gave him that authority? Why did he have the authority to come to that church and tell them what they needed to do? Well, look at chapter 10, verse 8. Even if I should boast somewhat more of our authority, which the Lord gave us for edification and not for your destruction, I shall not be ashamed. So the Lord gave him this authority. He's an apostle. He's chosen by Christ to do this great work. He has the authority over the church to tell them what to do. Also, if we turn over to chapter 13, verse 10, went too far there. 13, verse 10, we have the same kind of a thing. Therefore, I write these things absent, lest being present I should use sharpness according to the authority which the Lord has given me for edification and not for destruction. So he has this authority to be sharp if necessary. He doesn't want to be. He's praying. He's begging them not to force him to show this authority. But he's ready to do it. He could if he wants to be. So he would rather be severe or stern on paper so that he doesn't have to be severe in person. He did that intentionally. So as the people were accusing him of being weak and cowardly and timid, Paul would say, well, I'm trying to be meek and gentle with the gentleness of Christ. I'm trying to show Christ-like humility to you people. I'm ready to be stern. I'm ready to be severe if necessary, but I'd like to try to avoid that. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 4:21, this is reflected. 1 Corinthians 4:21, what do you want? Shall I come to you with a rod or in love and a spirit of gentleness? I can almost hear parents saying that to their children. Well, do you want me to treat you kindly and gently? Well, then just do what I tell you to do. But if not, there's always the rod and reproof and correction. Now, who made this charge against him? At the end of verse 2, against some who think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. In other words, people in the church who opposed Paul, the people who were perhaps false teachers, these people who had kind of wormed their way into the church, they're having an influence over the church for evil, teaching false ideas. Perhaps the charges here were that Paul was too authoritarian, too dictatorial, too proud, perhaps inconsistent. They were charging him with living, as it says here, walking or according to the flesh. In other words, not according to the Spirit. They were saying that Paul was not directed by the Spirit to do what he was doing, but by the flesh. In other words, just from human desires, human ideas. These were not coming from God, but he was being led by his own desires, his own will. He'll answer those accusations as we get into verse 3. Well, Christ-like humility and gentleness does not prohibit us from being bold and firm. Sometimes people think of Christians as only being gracious and kind and loving and tolerant. They think that's the beginning and end of Christianity, is just kindness and tolerance. Well, Paul is kind and tolerant as much as possible. He's lenient as much as he can be. But he's also ready to war. He's ready to go to war against these false teachers. So if people fail to respond when we approach them with meekness and gentleness, well, then we have to come, as Paul says, with the rod, with the sword of the Spirit, you know, with a more intense and a more zealous, a more assertive kind of an approach. We have to approach the conflict with boldness, courage, and confidence. It would be nice if we never had to confront people boldly and sternly. Wouldn't it be nice if we could approach conflict with grace and meekness and gentleness? In other words, just kind of a hint. Not approaching people with assertiveness or strength or sternness, but just sort of like, have you ever considered this? Maybe you ought to do this. Here's just an idea. Here's a suggestion. Maybe this would be the right way to go. Well, how do people respond to that oftentimes? They oftentimes don't respond well to that. Just a little hint, little suggestion, perhaps this, maybe this would be the right way. Instead, some people need that proverbial 2x4 across the head because they need a little bit stronger direction about what they need to do. But if we could approach all conflict with meekness and gentleness, just a little hint, just a little word to the wise, just a little suggestion, a little whisper in the ear. Oh, I see what you're trying to tell me. I see what I'm supposed to do. Okay, I'll change my behavior based on just a little bit of direction. Well, oftentimes people don't do that. So we find this theme in the Bible that sometimes we need to be bold and assertive. In fact, notice the word rebuke here in these verses. 1 Timothy 5:20, them that sin rebuke before all that others also may fear. That sounds kind of assertive. That kind of sounds pretty stern, doesn't it? Titus 1:13, rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in the faith. Titus 2:15, these things speak and exhort and rebuke with all authority. Let no man despise thee. So there are times when we need that assertiveness, that boldness, that clear, authoritative stance that many people don't like, but it's the right thing to do, especially when you're dealing with these false teachers like this. Sometimes that bold, strong, courageous confrontation is the only thing that's going to solve the problem. I've been reading a book called Caddy Woodlawn. Some of you probably know that book. And I've been reading that to Marin at night before she goes to bed. And it's a really well-written book. It's about a little girl in the kind of pioneer days, late 1800s, something like that. And there's one situation that I found very funny, very interesting, where it's a schoolroom situation, one-room schoolhouse, and there's a very badly behaved boy named Obadiah Jones. And in this one-room schoolhouse, Obadiah is a large boy, maybe early teenage or something like that. And the girl, the single girl who's the teacher there, is quite intimidated by this badly behaved Obadiah Jones. This boy threatens the young, rather timid female teacher, but the teacher gathers her courage and boldly deals with this boy. And here's the sentence that I thought was really good. It says, she whipped out her ruler and laid it sharply across that section of Obadiah's person on which he was accustomed to sit. Oh, I wonder what part of that body we're talking about there. The portion of his body on which he was accustomed to sit. They had an interesting way of telling you what they meant with language that it was, you know, non-offensive. But that's a good way to put it. That's a good threat that you could say, I'm going to whip out this ruler and lay it across that portion of your body on which you are accustomed to sit. Well, that bold action has an amazing effect on that boy. That boy was very badly behaved, but once he got that thrashing from this little young girl teacher, he shaped up and his behavior changed. Well, I'm not advocating violence here. I'm not advocating that we approach our conflicts with a ruler or something. But I am advocating at times boldness, courage, and authority if that's necessary. Spiritual warfare requires daring and bold action sometimes, especially when confronting error and rebellion. It's not easy or fun to confront people that way. But when it's necessary, we have to gather up the boldness and the courage of the Lord and confront the enemies of Christ and those who are standing against the gospel. And then thirdly, verse 3, wage warfare spiritually. Paul admits that we walk, as he says here, verse 3, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. So there's a difference here, a distinction between walking in the flesh and warring according to the flesh. Now remember that Paul's opponents, his adversaries, were accusing him of walking or living according to the flesh. Paul admits that he walks in the flesh, but not according to the flesh. The prepositions here are very important because it's a totally different thing to walk in the flesh and walk according to the flesh. To walk in the flesh simply means that we are part of this fleshly, sinful world. We are in this body, in this world. And because of that, we are subject to the limitations, the problems, the frailties, the failures of human life. We're all a bunch of humans. We're not any better or any worse than anybody else. As we look at everybody, we're all in the same boat. And so we're just part of this human life. He calls humans earthly vessels or earthen vessels. That's our human body. We're just clay pots, subject to the normal weaknesses and failures and frailties of human life. And we, like Paul, are just human vessels. We are subject to the flesh. We have limited abilities. We have frailties, just like any other person. As James says, we all stumble in many ways. So Paul isn't saying that he's not subject to the problems of this life. We are all weak. We all have failures and shortcomings. That's part of living, as it says, or walking in the flesh. However, he makes a distinction then between warring, as he says, according to the flesh. There's a big difference between doing something in the flesh, just as part of this natural human body, and according to the flesh. To do something according to the flesh would be that we are doing something like the unsaved world, according to the way that the world does things. Somebody said, we may walk softly, but we war strongly. It sounds a lot like what Teddy Roosevelt said, speak softly and carry a big stick. That's sort of like what Paul is saying here. When he's with them, he's trying to be soft, he's trying to be gentle and meek, but they should be aware that he carries a big stick. He has apostolic authority, and he's willing to use it. He's not afraid to use it. Paul describes this potential confrontation between himself and his opponents in military terms. He's ready to go to war. He's ready to have a fight. He's ready to engage in this battle. This whole section of the letter is full of military language and imagery. There are parallels between what the Roman army, the Roman military used to do, and what Paul is getting ready to do. He's going to talk about tearing down fortresses and taking people captive or taking ideas captive in the remainder of this passage. And so he's going to describe his approach to these people in terms of a war. As I said earlier, the main verb here is we war or we wage warfare. We're engaged in a military campaign. So this spiritual struggle is like a military battle. And that suggests something very important to us today, that the Christian life is like a battle. It's like a struggle. It's like a military engagement. We have spiritual enemies. And I'm not necessarily talking about other people, but the Bible describes our enemies as the world, the flesh, and the devil. These enemies are constantly against us. There's the battle between the flesh and the spirit. They wage war. They're constantly at odds with one another. And we don't expect that battle to end until we get to glory with the Lord. And in Paul's case, the enemies were these false teachers who had infiltrated the church and were leading people astray. And so Paul says, I'm ready to go to war with these people. I'm ready to engage in the spiritual hostilities against them. His intent, in fact, is to destroy their fortresses and their imaginations, as we'll look in verses 4 and 5. His intent is not simply to be victorious against them. He wants to destroy the things that they're teaching, primarily these false ideas. And so it's a battle. Some people, unfortunately, claim that the Christian life is more like a luxury vacation, or the Christian life is more like an amusement park than like a battle or a war. They say that we should expect to live our best lives now. They say that we should expect to be healthy and wealthy. We should expect God to solve all our problems. But here, Paul uses the imagery of war, a military engagement, to describe the Christian life. And so the question is not whether we will engage in this battle. The question is how to do so. How do we wage spiritual warfare? Well, he says we don't do it according to the flesh. That is, not like unsaved people from a worldly or a human perspective. We don't use human resources. We don't use dirty tricks or underhanded tactics. We don't use the worldly wisdom or clever methods. So he's not going to do this battle as unsaved people do, not according to the way that the world typically works. Somebody said, the follower of Christ cannot allow his conduct to be controlled by considerations of convenience and self-seeking, which were characteristic of the unregenerate world. To revert to the flesh is nothing less than undoing of the gospel. So this idea of the flesh battling or warring against the spirit, Paul uses that imagery to say, I'm not going to do it according to the regular ways that unsaved worldly people fight these battles. So although we live in a wicked world, we do not fight our battles according to worldly standards. We are in the world, as we know, but we're not of the world. We fight our battles using God's methods and God's standards. We don't fight our battles using the tactics of the unsaved world. And so we must be very careful to be on guard and not adopt the world's way of doing things. The unsaved world often uses methods that we would say are ungodly and sinful. They may be dishonest and unfair, even illegal. And we may be tempted to use those same kind of methods in our warfare. You know, they lied against us, so we're going to lie against them. They dragged our name into the mud, and so we're going to drag their name into the mud. It's tit for tat. They did this, we're going to do the same thing. Well, as Christian warriors, Christian soldiers marching as to war, as we sang, we dare not use the same tactics and methods of the unsaved world. We must not depend on evil worldly methods to gain a spiritual victory. We must not conduct spiritual warfare with fleshly weapons. He's going to go on to tell us about the weapons of our warfare. They're not carnal. They're not fleshly. They're not worldly. Instead, we use a different set of weapons. Sadly, the evangelical church at large has employed fleshly and worldly methods to accomplish its goals. Church leaders often observe what the world finds appealing and attractive, and they try to import that into the context of the church. Hey, it's working out there in the world. The secular world really likes this. And so we're going to try to Christianize it, give it a different name, give it a little bit different spin, and we'll use it in the church because, hey, it works in the world. Everybody else finds this attractive. And so we're just going to maybe clean it up a little bit and use it in the context of the church. They import the world's values into the church. And evangelicals, I think, in particular, are notorious for adopting whatever is new, whatever fad comes along, whatever trend appears in popular culture. They want to use that for the Lord. They think that they're capturing the unsaved, unregenerate world for Christ by using the things that come from the world into the church, thereby attracting people to come to church so that they hear the gospel message. Well, their intent is good. It's great for people to hear the gospel message, but to use the world's methods and the world's fads and the world's trends in the church to try to attract unsaved people, I think that's a real mistake. The other day I was at the library and just kind of perusing various things, and I saw a DVD called Jesus Revolution. I don't know if any of you have heard of that yet. It's a new film that's come out recently, and it's about essentially the Jesus People movement back in the 1960s and 70s. Some of us are old enough to remember having lived through the Jesus People movement. I was a very young child at the time. This happened, it's kind of starting, I think, out in the West Coast with the hippie movement from the 1960s and 70s. And there was an emphasis at that time to try to engage the hippie culture and really, you know, reach them for Christ and then kind of move that culture. What ended up happening was the hippie culture kind of moved into the church. Some churches, like in that film, they show some opposition to allowing the hippie-type people to come into the church, but eventually they sort of allow the hippie culture to essentially take over the church. And if you know anything about Calvary Chapel, if you've heard of Calvary Chapel, that is the outcome, you might say, of the Jesus People movement back in the early 70s. And now there are, I think, about 1,800 Calvary Chapel churches around the world. So it is a large movement with many, many people. Most large cities have a Calvary Chapel-style church. And so in certain ways, it was good to get the gospel out to these hippie people who needed to hear it. Many people heard the gospel and were saved. There are probably thousands, if not millions of people who came to Christ through the outreach of that, you know, Jesus People movement. And many of those people were genuinely saved. Some were not saved, just like any, you know, any campaign of evangelism. But the problem was not that these people were saved. The problem was essentially the capitulation of the church, the adaptation of the church to allow this revolutionary culture, the hippie culture. If you want to, you should study that a little bit, and you'll know that that is a revolutionary culture that was opposed to essentially the Christian culture. Well, they adapted the church. They reformulated the church to be appealing to that demographic, that group of people. Now, was that a good idea? Well, again, many people were saved, but I would suggest that in certain senses, that's a capitulation. That's a giving in to the desires and the ways of the world and allowing that, adapting the church, reformulating the church to be appealing to that group of people. Should we do that just to make sure that more people come in and sit in our pews, more people give offerings, more people are part of the ministry? Just find out what is attractive out in the world, find out what people are entertained by, find out what the latest trend and fad is, and say, okay, we're going to make a Christian version of that. Is that living according to the flesh? I would suggest that it is using the world's methods in the context of the church. And again, I think we need to be really careful about doing that. We certainly want to reach as many people as possible, but we don't want to compromise our standards or compromise biblical Christianity in an effort to win the lost. We want to win the lost, but we don't want to violate clear biblical principles in doing that. Now, I'm not necessarily charging Calvary Chapel with a total, you know, caving in. They retained the gospel. I think you'll still hear the gospel at a Calvary Chapel church. But what have they done regarding the culture? They've essentially adapted the church to espouse that hippie culture. Now, that's changed over the years. But now, whatever the unsaved people like, we're just going to try to do it in church to attract as many people as possible. That's an example. I think that's a perfect example of warring according to the flesh. We're going to use the world's standards. We're going to use the world's methods. We're going to use worldly imagery, worldly music, worldly appeal to try to do the Lord's work. Is that what we're supposed to do? No, we may live in the flesh. Okay, we have to live in this ungodly world, but we don't have to use the world's methods, at least not those that are directly associated with the unsaved, ungodly world. Adopting secular methods and standards usually has negative results. It drives the church into the ground. I mean, this is where essentially the mainline churches, that's what they did. They just adopted the world's methods, and where are the mainline churches today? They've lost almost everything. So we dare not do that. We dare not change or adapt the church for so-called success. We should not try to imitate or mimic the unsaved world in the church. That would be an example of using the world's methods and tactics for spiritual purposes. We must not wage warfare with fleshly, worldly approach. So we've seen that we approach our battles with meekness and gentleness. That's our default setting. We try to be gracious and meek and kind, and we try to solve our problems that way. And if that kind of approach doesn't solve the problem, then we need to be bold and assertive. In some cases, a stern and severe approach is appropriate. Ultimately, we wage warfare spiritually. We don't use the world's methods, the world's ideas. We try to stay away from those things because that's from a human point of view. We must use spiritual weapons that God provides, and Paul will discuss what kind of weapons these are in the remainder of the passage. Well, let's close in prayer.